Mrs. Casaubon, ma'am.
Oh, Mrs. Casaubon, how good of you to visit.
Mrs. Lydgate, we haven't met before, I think. I'm most glad of the opportunity.
I too. Tertius mentions you often.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Mrs. Lydgate. I'm anxious to see your husband, if possible. Could you tell me where I might find him?
Well, he's at the new hospital. I'm not sure how soon he will come home, but I could send for him at once.
Will you let me go and fetch him?
Mr. Ladislaw.
You know Mrs. Casaubon, I think, Will.
Yes. How are you, Mrs. Casaubon?
It was you. Singing. I had no idea. No thought of seeing you.
May I go to the hospital and tell Lydgate that you wish to see him? I should be most glad to perform this service for you.
Please sit down, Mrs. Casaubon.
No, wait. I'm sorry, Mrs. Lydgate, to be so... I will go myself, Mr. Ladislaw. Thank you. I wish to lose no time before getting home again. I'll drive to the hospital myself and see Mr. Lydgate there. Pray, excuse me.
May I escort you to your carriage?
You're very kind. That won't be necessary. I'm very much obliged to you both.
I quite envy you your acquaintance with Mrs. Casaubon. Is she very clever? She looks as if she were.
Really, I never thought about it.
That's just the sort of answer Tertius gives me when I ask about her. What is it you gentlemen are thinking of when you are with Mrs. Casaubon?
Herself. When one sees a perfect woman, one doesn't need to think of her attributes, only be conscious of her presence.
I shall be jealous when Tertius goes to Lowick. He will come back and think nothing of me.
Mrs. Casaubon is too unlike other women for them to be compared with her.
You are a devout worshipper, I perceive. She seemed a little melancholy.
Her husband, my cousin, has been very ill. Perhaps he's worse. That should be sufficient reason for her distraction, don't you think? What does that turn of the head betoken, Mrs. Lydgate?
Oh, only that it is not entirely melancholy in every respect to be mistress of Lowick Manor with an elderly and frail husband. You often see her, I suppose?
No. Worship is usually a matter of theory rather than practice. And as you imply, I am practicing it rather to excess at the moment. Forgive me. It is always fatal to have music interrupted. May I come another day? I really must tear myself away.
Pray come one evening instead. Mr. Lydgate would like to hear the music, and I cannot enjoy it so well without him.
I've observed you at Lowick often, Mrs. Casaubon, and I'm certain no one could attend a convalescent with more devotion.
It's so pitifully small a comfort to him. And he's often ill at ease with me, Mr. Lydgate, as though I irritate him further.
That could be a symptom of his physical weakness. Youth has its own energy, which sickness finds a burden sometimes.
I have not always been as patient and kind as I should be. I've sometimes been too fond of my own view of things. Strange. All my struggles to live well and understand better turn out to be built on ignorance and arrogance. I seem to have no use in the world after all. Not even to comfort my husband.
You must have other interests to feed your energies. You must occasionally think of your own pleasures.
So I've been told by others. You are kind. You were most kind to me when we met last. I was full of anger and self-pity.
You were distressed and shocked, Mrs. Casaubon, and rightly so. Your cry stayed with me. There are times in the life of a doctor when our helplessness matches those of our patients, and our skills are not adequate to the moment.
Don't believe it. You did me so much good.
I'm glad.
You look well and happy, Mr. Lydgate. I was delighted to meet your charming wife.
Thank you. I never saw myself a married man, but it agrees. It stops me from getting lost in my own obsessions. Mrs. Casaubon, in the spirit of my prescription, if I may distract you from your thoughts a moment, may I turn the tables and ask if you could help me?
Of course. I would be delighted to hear anything you wish to say to me. I consider you a friend.
Thank you. Do you recall, when I first had the pleasure of meeting you before your marriage at Tipton Grange, we were talking about the way in which the health of the poor was affected by bad housing?
Yes, indeed. Such issues have faded in my mind. They used to be so vivid. Lowick is such a tidy place. The villages are all comfortable and happy. But here, in Middlemarch, there must be a great deal to be done.
There's everything to be done.
And this beautiful new hospital. It must be a great joy to a man like you to be supervising such a wonderfully philanthropic project.
This place is a capital piece of work, due entirely to the exertions and money of Mr. Bulstrode. But now there's a mean, petty feud got up in the town against him and the hospital, and myself by connection. Certain persons wanted to fail.
But why?
Chiefly because it's Bulstrode's project.
What is there against him? I recall my uncle's friendly with him.
People don't like his religious tone. They feel it sits ill with his trade as a banker. And he is somewhat masterful and unsociable. But the main thing is that Bulstrode gave me, a new man, the direction of the hospital. And the entire medical profession in Middlemarch have set themselves against it and blacken its name for that reason alone.
How very petty. I used to think the world must be good at heart. But now I begin to think that I've been mistaken and naive about so many things.
The result is, no one's coming forward to assist in the funding. I don't lay claim to anything else other than having taken certain opportunities that came my way, and I did so because I believe I can set going a better method of treatment to the people who live here and conduct research of long-term benefit to all mankind. My course in this crisis is all the clearer from there being no salary attached to the post to put my persistence in an equivocal light. You will excuse my bluntness over all this, I hope.
I'm so very glad you've told me, Mr. Lydgate. I feel sure I can help a little. I have some money, too much money, and don't know what to do with it. I'm sure I can spare 200 a year for a grand purpose like this.
That would be... How can I ever thank you?
Nonsense. It's all the other way. Those of us with no real ability to comfort our fellows must do everything to help those who have the skills to do so. I'll mention the subject to Mr. Casaubon when I return, and you will come to Lowick and tell us more. I must hasten home now. How happy you must be to know you can and will do great work. To wake every morning to that knowledge. How I envy you, Doctor.
Is that enough music for you, my lord?
Yes, dear, if you're tired.
What is absorbing you, Tertius?
I'm thinking of a great fellow who was about as old as I am, 300 years ago, and had already begun a new era in anatomy.
I can't guess. We used to play guessing famous historical characters at Mrs. Lemon's, but they were never anatomists.
His name was Vesalius, and the only way he could get to know anatomy as he did was by going to snatch bodies at night from graveyards and places of execution.
Oh. I hope he's not one of your great heroes, else I shall have you getting up in the night to go to St. Peter's Churchyard. Seriously, Tertius, some people in the town were very shocked and angry, you know, when you asked Mrs. Goby's family if you could chop her up. And you have enemies enough already.
So had Vesalius, Rosie.
What happened to him?
He fought all his life, burned a good deal of his work. Then, as he was on his way to accept a chair in Padua, he was shipwrecked. He died rather miserably. Good thing your father made me take out a life insurance before he would bless our marriage, eh?
Do you know, Tertius, I often wish you had not been a medical man.
Don't say that, Rosie. You may as well say you wish you'd married someone else.
Not at all. You're clever enough for anything. And your cousins at Quallingham all think you've sunk below them in your choice of profession.
The cousins at Quallingham may go to the devil.
Still, I do not think it's a nice profession, dear.
It's the grandest profession in the world, Rosamond. And to say you love me without loving the medical man in me is the same as saying you like eating a peach except for its flavour. Don't say that again, dear. It pains me.
Very well, Dr. Greyface. Tell me about Mrs. Casaubon. What did she want to say to you?
Oh, she only wanted to ask me about her husband's health. But I think she's going to be splendid to our new hospital. She says she can give us 200 a year.
Do you think her very handsome, Tertius?
She certainly is handsome, but I've never thought about it.
I suppose it would be unprofessional.
It would be as a fine banquet spread before a well-fed man, Rosie. Come here upon my knee and kiss me, dear.
Mr. Ladislaw was here singing with me when Mrs. Casaubon came in. He seemed vexed. Do you think he disliked her seeing him at our house? Surely your position is more than equal to his, whatever may be his relation to the Casaubons. And I've heard Mr. Casaubon, at least, has cut him for being a newspaper man.
No. No, it must be something else than snobbery if he were really vexed. Ladislaw's a sort of gypsy. He thinks nothing of social distinctions.
Music apart, he is not always quite agreeable. Do you like him?
Yes. I think he's a good fellow. Rather miscellaneous and bric-a-brac, but likeable.
I think, you know, that he adores Mrs. Casaubon.
Poor devil.
Why, poor devil?
Why, what can a man do when he takes to adoring one of you mermaids? He only neglects his work and runs up bills.
I'm sure you don't neglect your work. You do nothing but go to the hospital or come home to pore over your microscopes and files. Confess that you like those things better than me.
Oh, Rosie.
Are you discontented with me, Tertius?
No, darling, no. I am too entirely contented. But a man must work, my dear. As the poet says, to do worthy the writing, and to write worthy the reading and the world's delight. Come, see if I don't make you proud to be a doctor's wife.
No, what we must work at now is the pioneer and political meetings, Mr. Brooke. Things will grow and ripen as if it were a comet year. Give it time. The public temper's slow to warm, then fast to ignite. It'll soon get to cometary heat now the question of reform has set in well and truly. There's likely to be another election shortly after this one, and by that time, Middlemarch will have got more ideas into its head.
Quite right, Ladislaw. We must make a new thing of opinion here. Only, I want to keep myself independent about reform, you know? Not go too far. I should support Grey, you know? I don't want to change the balance of the Constitution. I don't think Grey would. It's the French way, you know. One man, one vote. And we don't want to be going down that avenue.
We have to have a House of Commons with representatives from interests other than those of the landed class. And as for contending for reform short of that, it's like asking for a bit of an avalanche when it's already begun to thunder.
Oh, that is fine, Ladislaw. That's the way to put it. Write that down now. You have a way of putting things. Burke. Now, when I think of Burke, I can't help wishing someone had a pocket borough to give you, Ladislaw. Never get elected, you know. The avalanche and the thunder now was really a little like Burke. I want that sort of thing. Not ideas, you know, but a way of putting them. Shift the pegs a little, and I shall be in the cabinet and you undersecretary. The little waves make the large ones, eh, and so forth. We'll make a bit of difference in the world, eh, Ladislaw? Excellent.
It's no use your puffing Brooke in the Pioneer as a reforming landlord, Ladislaw. They only pick more holes in his coat in the Trumpet.
No matter. Those who read the Pioneer don't read the Trumpet. Do you suppose the public ever chooses its reading matter with a view to its own conversion? We read according to our prejudices.
Tea, Tertius. I have your cup here, Mr. Ladislaw, if you can bear to rise from a run to accept it.
Delightful, thank you.
My Fairbrother says he doesn't believe Brooke would ever get elected for Middlemarch. Not with that Tory bulldog Hawley snarling against reform. Hawley has too many friends in high enough places, he says.
Well, not this time round, perhaps, but no harm in trying in the future. It's good to have local members.
Why?
They represent local stupidity better.
That's the way with you political writers, crying up a measure as if it were a universal cure, and crying up men who are a part of the disease that wants curing.
Pragmatism, Lydgate. Men may help to cure themselves off the face of the land without noticing if you shape them right. Brooke's not a bad fellow, and he's done some good things on his estate now it has a benefit to him. The tenants aren't questioning his motives half as much as they're enjoying their new roof slates.
You go against rottenness, but there's nothing more rotten than making people believe society can be cured by political hocus-pocus.
That's fine and good, dear fellow, but your cure must begin somewhere. If we wait for conscience and wisdom in public agents, hell will freeze over first.
The only conscience we can trust is self-interest, and the only wisdom we can hope to attain is finding a fine way of balancing different levels of selfishness. Society is a conspiracy of mutual egoism. How are we to find immaculate men to work with, eh? You settled for Bulstrode, Lydgate, and with good reason.
Bulstrode lets me carry reforms through in the hospital. I go with him for that. I don't cry him up on any personal ground.
Are you saying, then, that I cry up Brooke on any personal ground?
What?
I think it's pretty clear my personal independence is as important to me as yours is to you. I don't care for money or my place in the world.
You quite mistake me, Ladislaw. I think of you much more as having a reckless and romantic disregard for your own wealth and position. See how often you lie on my hearth rug. And what if the king came to tea?
How very unpleasant you both are this evening. And why should money be referred to at all? Surely medicine and politics are sufficiently disagreeable to quarrel on.
Poor Rosie. Disputation is not amusing to cherubs. I really do beg your pardon for unintentionally annoying you, Ladislaw. And I must also now beg you to take my part in healing the mood of the evening and sing with Rosie. Would you?
You will oblige me, my dear Dorothea, if instead of other reading this evening, you will go through this table of contents aloud, pencil in hand, and at each point where I say mark, will make a cross with your pencil. This is the first step in a sifting process which I have long had in view and have too long delayed. As we go along, I shall be able to indicate to you certain principles of selection, which you will learn to discern intelligently for yourself. I trust this is acceptable to you.
I've always wished to help, Edward. I like best to do what assists you in your work. But it is quite late. You look so very tired. Perhaps it would be better to rest and begin this in the morning.
On the contrary, my dear. I feel curiously alert and ready for a task which, I confess, hitherto daunted even my powers of devotion. So, let us begin.
First excursion on the fertility rituals of Crete, including Minoan.
Mark that.
Sympathetic magic, the laws of contagion and similarity in the rituals of Nemi.
Mark.
Second excursion on rituals of Cretan origin.
Pass on to the next head.
Osiris and the popular Egyptian harvest rituals.
Mark.
It's my feeling as this new doctor means to let people die in his hospital for the sake of cutting them up without so much as a buy your leave or with your leave. A refill, Mr. Mumsy? I have strong opinions on this matter. The slide down the better with refreshment.
Your opinion is a bulwark against the rising tide of mischief in this town, Mrs. Dollop. I've always said as much to Mrs. Mumsy.
Well, say what you like about bringing people back from the brink of death, Mr. Mumsy. And I don't say, as Mr. Fred Vince's typhoid weren't caught in the nick of time...
And there was Nancy Nash. She had a tumour because a duck's egg, according to Dr. Minchin. And it dissolved after Lydgate prescribed a blister, Mrs. Dollop. That was a thing witnessed by the surgeon at the new hospital, who was all set to cut the thing out before Lydgate spoke to him.
So, say what you like about these things, it's a fact that he wanted to cut up Mrs. Goby after she were dead. Mrs. Goby, as respectable a woman as any in Parley Street who had money in trust before her marriage. And if we're not safe dead on the slab, Mr. Mumsy, we won't be safe in our graves next. Be Burke and Eyre all over again, you mark my words.
Well, as I say, I've nothing against Lydgate, Mrs. Dollop, in cases of fever or where there's liver, but there remains in my mind the matter of the purifying pills. He won't prescribe them. And Mrs. Mumsy has never been through a confinement without them.
Gracious! You see my drift with this new sort of high-handed doctoring? Such dreadful trifling with people's constitution.
He won't dispense at all. I asked him for some of Mrs. Mumsy's strengthening medicine, and he replied as if to say, Mumsy, you're a fool.
No.
But I smile at it. I humour everybody's weak place. If physic had done harm to self and family, I should have found it out by this time, I think. Let fads and fashions pass. I know what's best for me and mine, Mrs. Dollop.
You knew I was a meddler from the start, Lydgate, and I'm concerned to see you looking so sombre. Won't you tell me a little of your worries?
Oh, it's nothing much, fair brother. Nothing we're not most of us acquainted with sooner or later. I've been lucky hitherto, never having to think beyond affording the best cloth for my suits and having the few sticks of furniture I owned of the best, and still having money in the bank.
Ah, it's a financial cloud. Here's a man will have nothing but sympathy for that. I know, by a word you let fall one day, that you don't like my playing cards at the Vinces or billiards at the Tankard for money. You're right enough there. But stay clear of wanting small sums you haven't got. Take me as a bad example.
I'm ashamed of my past priggishness, fair brother. You have a household of four to support on a very narrow income.
Ah, but you forget. My Aunt Henrietta takes a basket to every table in the town and gathers sugar cubes and crumbs clandestinely. Alas, the booty goes to the more ragged street children. I never see a single cake crumb. We are blessed in our burdens, Lydgate.
Rosamond will be glad I'm out of the house this evening. She's weary of my frowns, and I know I hurt her very much when I'm out of temper.
Have you told her the reason?
No. No. She is in a delicate state, fair brother, and I do not wish to worry her in any way. You understand me?
I do. And congratulate you both. I see now why the debt is galling to your spirits, Lydgate.
Oh, it's not so severe as that. I've just not recovered from the wedding expenses as quickly as I thought. And at the beginning of this week, I had a disagreeable letter insisting on payment for some furniture and plate. I'm at my worst when embarrassed, fair brother.
I understand that. Pride is the last friend we abandon in a tight place. But I'm sure your wife would want to share this trouble with you. She understands as well as you and I that your work at the hospital is done gratis, and that there are factions in the town battling to undermine your position for political reasons.
They won't drive me away. Things will settle by and by if I go more quietly. But I'm frustrated with myself, too, about losing time on my tissue experiments. Raspail and others in Paris are on the same track, I read. And I have no seductions from home now. I should be getting on faster with my work. My indolence galls me. I may be overtaken.
Well, I have no powers of prophecy there. But as to the hostility in the town, I agree. You'll weather it if you're prudent.
How can I be prudent? I do what comes before me to do, as best I can. And I can't help people's ignorance and spite any more than Vesalius could. If I conducted myself according to foolish notions, I would be as big a threat to my patients as Wrench was to Fred Vincey. Yet I'm the villain there, it seems, not Wrench.
I don't speak of fairness, Lydgate. I speak of prudence. Although this may sound like personal feeling in me to say so, and there's a good deal of that, I own, keep yourself as far away from Bulstrode as you can. That's my advice. My feeling is there's danger there you cannot rationalise under the microscope. Do your work, and let Bulstrode well alone.
Are you ill, Edward?
I felt some uneasiness in a reclining posture. I will sit here for a time.
You should have woken me. I'll put more wood on the fire. You would like me to read more headings from your notebooks to you?
You would oblige me greatly by doing so, Dorothea. I am wakeful. My mind is remarkably lucid. In fact, close the book, dear. We will resume that task tomorrow. But you do observe the principle on which my selections are made, I hope. Giving adequate but not disproportionate illustration to each of the theses enumerated in the introduction. You have perceived that distinctly, Dorothea.
Yes.
And now I think that I can take some repose. But before I sleep, I have a request to make.
What is it?
It is that you will let me know deliberately whether, in case of my death, you will carry out my wishes. Whether you will not act in any way I shall deprecate, and instead apply yourself to do what I should desire.
I don't fully understand your meaning, I think.
You refuse?
I do not yet refuse, Edward. But how can I promise when I'm ignorant of what it will bind me to or from? Whatever affection prompted, I would, of course, do without promising.
I have no doubt of that. I require that you use my judgment in place of your own. You refuse.
No, dear, no. But may I wait and reflect a while? I desire with my whole soul to do what will comfort you, but I cannot give any pledge suddenly. Still less a pledge to do I know not what.
You cannot then confide in the nature of my wishes as a trusting wife ought to do.
Grant me until tomorrow morning.
Very well. Till tomorrow, then.
Sleeping in the chair.
Is it late, Tan?
9 o'clock, ma'am. I thought you would be with Mr. Casaubon. I never saw you look so pale, madam.
Was I ever high-coloured, Tantrip?
Well, not to say high-coloured, no. You had a bloom like a china rose. Oh, not now you spend every day sniffing those leather books. God bless you, madam. Do rest a little this morning. Let me say you're really not able to bear that stuffy library.
Oh, no. No, I must make haste and dress. Mr. Casaubon wants me particularly.
He isn't in the library, madam. Pratt says he saw his master go towards the yew tree walk an hour ago.
Edward! You must not sleep here without a thicker cloak, dear. The bench and table are too hard and cold. Let me help you rise.
Edward? I am come, Edward. I am ready to promise. Only thinking about it made me feel rather ill. Not very ill. I shall soon be better. Wake, dear. Wake. Listen to me. I am come to answer. Edward?
I wish to God we could hinder Dorothea from knowing this.
That would be difficult, you know, Chetham, as she is executrix and likes to go into these things when she's better, you know. And she was 21 last December, you know? I can hinder nothing. She'll want to see the will.
All business must be kept from her until she's well. As soon as she's able to move, I shall take her home with me. Being with Celia and the baby will be the best thing in the world for her. And meanwhile, you, Brooke, will get rid of Ladislaw.
Easily said, Chetham. Easily said, you know.
You brought him here, and you keep him here. He must go at once. Damn Casaubon. To couple Ladislaw's name with Dorothea's in a codicil, there never was a meaner, more ungentlemanly act.
Casaubon was a little twisted about Ladislaw, but it's hardly Ladislaw's fault. And he can't be shipped off like a head of cattle, my dear fellow. He has his own ideas, you know. It all goes for nothing, you see. She doesn't want to marry Ladislaw.
This codicil is framed to make everyone believe she does. I don't believe anything of the sort about Dorothea, but I suspect Ladislaw. I tell you frankly, I suspect Ladislaw. Dorothea was sacrificed once because her friends were too careless. I shall do what I can as her brother-in-law to protect her now.
But what can I do? Ladislaw's a gentleman.
I'm glad to hear it. I'm sure Casaubon was not.
Look, Dodo. Look at him. Oh, did you ever see anything like that?
What, Kitty?
What? Why, his upper lip, as though he's got his little thoughts. Oh, do look at him. Dodo, you're crying. Don't be sad. What upsets you so? I'm certain you did everything and a deal too much. You should be happy now.
I wonder if Sir James would drive me to Lowick. I want to look over everything. There may be words written for me I should know about, Celia.
Dr. Lydgate will be coming to see you soon, and you shall not go until he says you may go. I can see what you're thinking of, Dodo. You're wanting to find out if there's anything uncomfortable for you to do now, and you've already been uncomfortable enough, and Mr. Casaubon doesn't deserve it. James is as angry with him as can be. And I'd better tell you to prepare you.
If he's left his property away from you, it would be a relief, I assure you.
Mr. Casaubon has made a codicil to his will to say the property was all to go away from you if you married. I mean...
That's of no consequence. I don't...
But if you married Mr. Ladislaw, not anybody else. Of course, that is of no consequence in one way. You never...
You will let me know whether you will not act in any way I shall deprecate, and instead apply yourself to do what I should desire.
I don't understand.
You are a poem.
I trust I may be excused, especially from guests whose desultory vivacity makes them a fatigue.
If I can ever, ever be of the slightest service to you.
And who is Mr. Ladislaw?
Young relative of Casaubon's.
A very pretty sprig. What is your nephew to be, Casaubon?
If I can ever, ever be of the slightest service to you.
You can. I like you very much.
If ever.
Dodo. What is it, Dodo?
Mr. Lydgate, madam.
Oh, Dr. Lydgate. My sister has had a shock. She's very unwell.
I fear you're not so well as you were, Mrs. Casaubon. Have you been agitated? Let me feel your pulse.
She wants to go to Lowick to look over the papers. She ought not to, ought she?
Mrs. Casaubon?
It's as though everything is slipping and changing in my head. Dissolving and reforming. Dr. Lydgate, he thought... All the time, he thought... He didn't trust me. He never trusted or believed in who I was. He never knew me. And I never knew.
She oughtn't to go, ought she?
I hardly know. In my opinion, Mrs. Casaubon should do what would bring her the most repose of mind. Sometimes the patient knows best what that would be.
Thank you. I want to go to Lowick and to visit my uncle at Tipton. I want to visit old places. I want to see old places. Places where I was happy.
This looks well, eh? I shall have a good audience at any rate. I like this now, this kind of public made up of one's neighbours, you know. I'll take another glass of sherry, Vincey. That is law. Shake hands.
And here's the speech, sir.
Good luck, Brook.
Right. Vincey. Right. Gentlemen, electors of Middlebart, I'm uncommonly glad to be here. I was never so proud and happy in my life. Never so happy, you know? And Parliament. Parliament is dissolved. Yes. Yes, and so this is a time... Action, you know.
Speech, sir. Put on your glasses and read the...
I'm a close neighbour of yours, my good friends. Always been on the bench. Gone a good deal into public questions. Machinery now. And machine breaking. It won't do, you know. Everything must go on. Trade and so forth. All over the globe. From China to Peru, as Johnson says. That is what I've done up to a certain point. Not as far as Peru, but I have been in the Levant, where some of your Middlemarch goods go. And the Baltic now.
The Baltic now?
Mr. Brook, the speech, sir. Yes,
that reminds me. There is Chatham, you know. I wouldn't have supported Chatham or Pitt. He was not a man of ideas. And we want... Ideas, you know.
Blast your ideas, we want the bill!
Blast your ideas, we want the bill!
Yeah. There's something in what you say, my good friend. And what do we meet here for but to speak our minds? Freedom of opinion, freedom of the press, liberty,
That kind of thing.
Liberty! That kind of thing!
Yes. The bill now. You shall have the bill.
And you shall have the bill, Mr. Brooke. Cost of one electioneering contest and a seat in the mud as delivered. £5,000, 7 shillings and fourpence. Plus 2 dozen eggs.
It won't do. Buffoonery, tricks, all that is very well.
Come inside, we must go in, sir. They're pelting rotten food, Vincey.
It was Bowyer did the voice. He's uncommon good at ventriloquism, I know, and I saw Hawley looking smug. He must have paid for the effigy. It looked damnably like you, Brooke.
Pity. I should have had them listening, but they didn't give me time. Pity. I should have had their ear by and by.
There was a great silence in the house, Mr. Lydgate. It was so very empty. There were no words addressed to me. I had some small hope he may have... There was only a synoptical tabulation notated for the use of Mrs. Casaubon. He mentioned to you, I think, his hopes to write a great volume on the key to all mythologies. He became very focused on it after speaking with you. We worked day and night on sifting and ordering.
Yes. It's not unusual in someone shaken by sudden, acute ill health to focus on an unfulfilled dream and imagine the impossible can be done at once. You seem much calmer to me now. What will you do with your husband's research?
I have had a long time to pause and consider many things in the light of newer knowledge about my husband's state of mind at the time of his death. And I decided I could no longer submit my soul to another's by working hopelessly at what I no longer have belief in. Do you disapprove?
No.
Though I couldn't quite escape old superstitions. I sealed the synoptical tabulation in an envelope which contained a note from me to Edward saying I couldn't use it. And now I feel ready to return to Lerwick and live there in my own way, as far as I can. You approve of that, I hope?
I approve. And now I feel confident that I may open the topic of the Lowick living, which is in your gift.
Oh, yes. Uncle has recommended Mr. Tyke to me. Do you know him?
Instead of telling you about Mr. Tyke, I should very much like to tell you of another man, desirous of seizing his own destiny. Mr. Fairbrother, the vicar of St. Botolph's. His living is a poor one. I believe he never married because he couldn't afford to. And I never heard such good preaching as his, such plain, easy eloquence. I think him an all-round remarkable fellow who knows he ought to have done more.
And you know well I'm interested now in all who slip below their own intention. Why has he not done more?
That's a hard question. He has family burdens. He may, at times, feel himself in the wrong profession. He has a passion for natural history, that I know. And he's earned some gossip by being a good hand at whist and taking money for it, which his enemies proclaim against him. But he's the best, most honest man I know, with neither venom nor doubleness in him. And he is very much beloved by his parishioners at St. Botolph's.
I should like to see Mr. Fairbrother and hear him preach.
Do. I trust to the effect of that. Ladislaw is a great friend of Fairbrother. He will sing his praises to you if you ask. But I forget my duty as your doctor. You are tired now, and I must leave you to rest, Mrs. Casaubon.
Well, Ladislaw. Well.
Well, Mr. Brooke.
I find I must pull up. Poor Casaubon was a warning, you know. I have felt uneasy about the chest. It won't do to carry that too far. I've made some heavy advances. I've dug a channel. It's rather coarse work, this electioneering, eh? I dare say a man of your gifts is tired of it, eh? However, we've dug a channel with the pioneer, put things on a track and so on. A more ordinary man than you might carry it on now. More ordinary, you know?
Do you wish me to give it up? I'm ready to do so whenever you wish.
As to wishing, my dear Ladislaw, I have the highest opinion of your powers, you know? But I have been consulting with some men on our side, and they are inclined to take the paper into their hands. And they might not take that high view of you which I have always taken. I think of having a run into France. But I'll write you any letters to Althorp and people of that kind in London. I've met Althorp.
I'm exceedingly obliged to you. Since you are parting with the Pioneer, I need not trouble you about the steps I shall take. I may choose to continue here for the present.
Well, now, free spirit. That's right. I said you'd say so. But I'm for France, you know. For a while. I shall be sorry to leave my friends, but a man must travel a bit. Eh?
Comfort, Camden, is that you have deserved it.
When a man gets a good berth, Mother, most of the deserving must come after. With the livings of St. Botolph's and Lowick, I shall now be able to make as good a clergyman out of myself as I can. There will always be sugar candy on the table for Aunt Henrietta to steal and give to the children. And Winnie can fall in love with a Lowick bachelor now, and I shall make no difficulty over wedding expenses.
You must set her the example, Camden. You must marry too. You are a handsome man, though not so fine a figure as your father was. But you will want your whist at home when we move to Lowick, and a wife would be most useful.
I shall do without whist now, Mother.
Still, I wish you would marry Miss Garth, Camden. She makes us so lively when she visits us.
Very fine. You talk as if young women were tied up to be chosen like poultry at a market, as if I only had to ask and she would have me. But who knows what I may do, Mother? Now I'm a rich man.
Nick Bulstrode? By Jove, Nick, it is you. I couldn't be mistaken. Though the 5 and 20 years have played old bogey with us both. How are you, eh? You didn't expect to see me here. Come, shake us by the hand.
Mr. Raffles, I didn't expect to see you in this remote country place.
I'll be bound. But it belongs to a stepson of mine who fell on fertile ground. And I'm not so surprised at seeing you, old fella, because when I came here some weeks since, I tore a scrap of paper off Josh's desk to make my flask fit snug in its lever. And damn me, when I came to draw it out, if it didn't have your name on it, Nick. And us being such old friends who'd sadly lost touch, I came to ask Josh your address. But now you're here, Nick, we can both walk home together.
I was going back to town, but I can defer my ride a little. And you can, if you please, rest here.
Thank you. I don't care now about seeing my stepson. I'd rather stick to you.
Mr. Rig Featherstone is here no longer. I am master of Stone Court now.
Well, old fellow, you always had such a gift for improving your luck. How fortunate there's someone popped up from the past who appreciates just how your luck first took such a turn, eh? But by Jove, you're looking very pale and pasty on a sudden. Nick, let's go in and have a toast.
I'm so very glad for you, Mr. Fairbrother, about the living at Lowick. It couldn't happen to a better man.
Thank you, Fred. Sit down. I'm ready to hear anything you wish to say, but you won't mind if I pack up my collection as I listen. I've given up my pipe, you see, turning a new leaf, and I concentrate better when I'm busy.
You know Father still insists I go into the church.
I did talk to your father about it, Fred, but he wasn't to be moved. And you're over one bridge now with your degree. What are your other difficulties?
That I don't like divinity and preaching and being obliged to look serious. I like riding across country, as other men do. But we have no capital to get me into farming. I must earn something, Father says, and pay my way. What do you think?
I can only tell you about myself, that I've always been too lax and have been uneasy in consequence. Have you any difficulties about doctrine?
No, I suppose the articles are right. It'd be ridiculous of me to urge scruples of that sort, as if I were a clever fellow.
Has it occurred to you that you might be a fair parish priest without being much of a divine? I would do my utmost to help you on. After a time, not at first, of course, you might be with me as my curate.
Of course, if I'm obliged to be a clergyman, I shall try and do my duty, though I mayn't like it. But there is another hindrance. I didn't tell you before, though I expect you guessed. There's someone I've loved ever since we were children.
Miss Garth, I suppose.
Yes. I shouldn't mind anything if she would have me. And I know I could be a good fellow then.
And you think she returns the feeling?
She never will say so. She wants me to be a good fellow first. And over the business with the debt, she made me promise not to speak to her again about it. But I can't give her up, and I do think she cares about me. I saw Mrs. Garth last night, and she says Mary's staying at Lowick Rectory with your sister.
Yes, she's very kindly helping Winifred to get the house ready.
I want to ask a great favour of you. Mary will listen to you if you mention the subject to her, about me going into the church, I mean. She respects you more than anyone.
That is rather a delicate task, my dear Fred.
I'm ashamed to bother you, but I don't know what I shall do unless I can get at her feeling.
You mean you would let Mary's feelings guide your decision about the church?
If Mary doesn't want me, I may as well go wrong one way as another.
That's nonsense, Fred. Men outlive their love, but they don't outlive the consequences of their recklessness.
Not my sort of love. I've never been without loving Mary. When we were little, I married her with an umbrella ring. If I had to give her up, it would be like beginning to live with wooden legs.
She might be embarrassed at my knowing of and intruding into this affair between the two of you.
No, I shouldn't have trusted anyone else. She'll know that. There's no one else who could be such a friend to both of us.
Very well, my boy. I will do what you wish. I shall ride to Lowick this afternoon.
Ride? You have a horse now, Mr. Fairbrother. What a swell you are!
My very own nag, which I've just set up. Come and see her, Fred, and laugh at my ignorance and extravagant folly.
You and me. Just like old times, eh, Nick? By Jove, my feelings have ripened for you like old cognac. Well, I hope you've got some in the house now. It's as cold as Christmas in here, Nick. Aren't you going to light the fire for me and join me in a drink?
Your habits and mine are so different, Mr. Raffles, that we can hardly enjoy each other's society. As my wife and I are not yet in residence, you are permitted to remain here for the night and will leave after you have breakfasted. And now, as you have supped and I have little time to spare, may I ask first why you returned from America? I thought you had been furnished with a sum sufficient to set you up there for life.
America didn't suit me, Nick. Those Yankees are cool hands. 10 years was long enough, and I'm not going again. I married when I came back. A nice woman in the tobacco trade, and inherited nothing but my unfilial stepson, Josh.
Do you wish to be settled in any business? What is your calling now?
Thank you. I have developed a tender conscience and retired from snooping now, Nick. The calling you once so vigorously supported me in. My calling is to enjoy myself as much as I can. I want an independence.
That can be arranged. In return for your promise to keep your distance.
That must be as suits my convenience. I won't be packed off like a mangy cur.
Surely, Mr. Raffles, if you intend to rely on me in any way, you must expect to meet my wishes.
Ah, to be sure. Didn't I always? Lord, you made a pretty thing out of me. I got but little. I often thought since I might have done better by telling the old woman I'd found her daughter and a grandson. Only then, Nick, you wouldn't have married her and buried her and got her money, eh? Now you're buying land and being a country bashaw. Still in the dissenting line, are you? Still godly? Or taken to the church as more genteel? I've not had such fine luck as you. By Jove.
I'm willing to supply you with a regular annuity in quarterly payments, so long as you fulfil a promise to remain at a distance from this neighbourhood.
Your quarterly payments don't suit me. I like my freedom. Tell you what, Nick, give us a couple of hundred. Calmness modest, and I'll go away. On a bright. Have you the money on you?
No. I have 100. I will forward you the other if you will mention an address.
No, I'll wait till you bring it. Take advantage of your kind hospitality. You ride over with it after breakfast, and I'll go. You look shaky, Nick. Perhaps you should get out the cognac first, eh? And we can toast our reunion.
Very well.
I did have another look after Sarah again, though I didn't tell anyone. I'd a tender conscience about the pretty young thing. I didn't find her, but I found out her husband's name and made a note of it. But hang it, I lost my pocketbook. If I heard it, I'd know it again. And I'll tell you, Nick. Nick, you'd like to do something for her. Or the lad, eh? But, deuce, what was the name? Began with an L. It was almost all L's, I fancy.
Adam will be down directly, Mr. Ladislaw.
Thank you, Tantrip. How are you?
Well, glad to see you here again, sir.
I'm only come to say goodbye, Tantrip.
Oh, very sorry to hear it, sir. Morning, Mr. Ladislaw. Please take a seat.
I hope I haven't presumed too much in calling. It's so long since we met. And that was in company.
Mrs. Lydgate. Yes, I remember. It does seem a long time ago.
I couldn't bear to leave the neighbourhood and begin a new life without seeing you to say goodbye.
I should have thought it unkind if you hadn't wished to see me. Are you going away immediately?
Very soon, I think. To train as a barrister. That's the best way into politics, and I seem to have developed a taste for it. There's much to do in the world, and I mean to do some of it by and by.
I'm so glad. I thought in Rome you only cared for poetry and art as adornments for a wealthy life. Now I know you think about the rest of the world.
So you approve of my going away for years and never coming back until I've made something of myself?
It must be right for you to do as you say. I shall be very happy to hear you've made your value felt. But remember, you are impatient, as I once was, and it might take a very long time.
You'll forget all about me?
No. I'll never forget you. I have a great deal of space for memory at Lowick, I think you'll agree.
I cannot...
I wonder whether you would like to have that miniature in my boudoir. That beautiful picture of your grandmother. It isn't right for me to keep it if you wish to have it. It's very like you.
Why should I have that when I have nothing else?
You must understand. It pains me very much. I cannot do more.
It's not very consoling to have one's own likeness. It would be more consoling if others wanted to have it. And a man with only a portmanteau for his stowage must keep his memorials in his head.
You're much the happier of the two, Mr. Ladislaw, to have nothing of the past and a bright future of action ahead of you.
I never felt it a misfortune to travel light until now. But poverty may be as bad as leprosy if it divides us from what we most care for.
Sorrow comes in so many ways. 2 years ago, I had no notion of that. I mean, of how trouble comes and ties our hands and makes us silent when we long to speak.
Sir James has arrived, madam.
Ask Sir James to come in here.
Sir?
Dorothea?
I must say goodbye, Mrs. Casaubon. And for a long while.
Goodbye. And God bless you, Mr. Ladislaw.
Say that I will ever be Fred's wife, Mr. Fairbrother, but I will certainly never be his wife if he becomes a clergyman. I couldn't love a man who is ridiculous. You think me harsh?
Fred wishes me to report exactly what you think, Miss Garth.
Fred knows what I think.
Pardon me, Mary, but when the state of a woman's affections touches the happiness of another life, of more lives than one, perhaps, I think it would be the nobler course for her to be perfectly direct and open. Either your feeling for Fred Vincey excludes your entertaining another attachment, or it doesn't. You must say. You must.
Since you think it my duty, Mr. Fairbrother, I will tell you that I have too strong a feeling for Fred to give him up for anyone else. I should never be quite happy if I thought he was unhappy for the loss of me. It has taken such deep root in me, you see. My gratitude to him for always loving me best, since we were children.
Then I have fulfilled my commission thoroughly. With this prospect before Fred, we shall get him into the right niche somehow. And I hope I shall live to join your hands.
Oh, please stay, and let me give you some tea.
No, my dear, no. I must get back. Goodbye, Mary. And God bless you.
I wish you would talk more to Captain Lydgate at dinner, Tertius. You seem to look through his head to the wallpaper when he speaks to you.
But, my dear Rosie, you can't expect me to talk much to a conceited ass like that, I hope. If he got his head broken now, I might look at it with interest. Not before.
I cannot conceive why you should speak of your cousin so contemptuously. I have looked forward to his visit since we went to Qualingham on our wedding tour.
If I'd known it would result in my cousin cluttering my house, drinking my wine and flirting with my wife for 2 weeks, I would never have gone to Qualingham.
Captain Lydgate is a thorough gentleman, and I think you ought not, out of respect to Sir Godwin, to treat him with neglect.
We have had dinners for him. You attend him assiduously, and he goes in and out all day. He doesn't want me. His conversation is as vapid as Ned Plimdale's used to be.
The captain may not be a phoenix of cleverness in your sense, but I think his conversation quite agreeable.
The fact is, you would wish me to be a little more like him, Rosie.
Oh. Tertius.
Mr. Garth! Hold that roll steady, Tom, and we won't get the distance accurate.
But Mr. Garth! Who are those men Hiram and the other A-turners are waving their pitchforks at?
What? Oh, the fools.
What are they threatening?
Railway men, Tom. Fetch the spirit level, lad, and we'll get over there.
You've been cutting Lowick Parish into sixes and sevens like a harvest pie. There'll be no stirring from one place to t'other for the likes of us.
You men have been at the side of we're on lawful business here.
Lawful, he says. It do harm the land and the cattle, and it do harm us too, your lawful business.
Now, lads.
You're not to do the men harm, boys. Mr. Garth's
what,
already...
What, boy? Get out of my road. Out, I say.
Oh!
They're running. Come on, lads. Ah. Let's get them.
Tom!
What do you confounded fools mean? You've knocked the lad down and killed him, for what I know.
Tom!
Will every one of you be hanged at the next assizes, if you don't mind.
Tom, you're right.
You're a coward, you are, Fred Vincey. You get off your horse, young sir, and I'll have a round with you, I will.
I'll have a round with you all in turn, if you like.
Fred! Tom's come to now, but sprained an ankle. Could be worse. But he must sit on your horse to get home.
Here, Tom, let me help you.
I can manage, Mr. Fred.
Your lip is bleeding.
Go home with the surveyor's gear, Tom. You should catch him soon enough to give it back. Take care now.
Yes, sir.
Why, my lads, how's this? How can you to make such a mistake as this?
Honest.
The railroad is to be made whether you like it or not.
We don't like it.
They do a bit of harm here and there. And so do you, lads. And so does the sun in heaven. And if you fight, you'll get yourselves into trouble.
This is the big folks' world, this is. But you're for the big folks, Mr. Garth, you are.
You don't think well of me, Tim, never mind. It's neither here nor there now. I don't want you lads to make things worse for yourselves.
It were only a piece of fun.
Then back to your work, boys. Let no more be said.
That's why something ain't him.
Deuce take it. This is what comes of men being fools. I'm hindered in my day's work. Can't get along without someone to hold this measuring chain. What have you got to do today, young Fred?
Nothing, Mr. Garth. I'll help you with pleasure. Can I?
With the baby so near delivery. Rosamond, what could you have been thinking? Why didn't you ask me? I am your husband and your physician.
I did not tell you I intended to go out riding until afterwards, Tertius, because I knew you would forbid it, even though you know how I've missed it.
Captain Lydgate was kind enough to bring me the grey to ride.
He's a damn coxcomb, how dare he?
She is very quiet. And you see, there was no danger. I feel very well.
You have come back safely, thank God. But you will not go again, Rosie. I am the person to judge for you. I shall tell the captain. He ought to have known better.
I beg you will not do anything of the kind. You'll be treating me as if I were a child. Promise that you will leave the subject to me.
Very well. Tell him you won't be riding again.
Oh, I wish you would fasten up my plaits, dear. No one does it as nimbly as you do.
As I thought, Susan. The children are fond of each other. Fred and Mary. After we'd done our work, Fred poured it all out to me. He can't bear to be a clergyman, and Mary says she won't have him if he is one, and the lad would like to be under me and give his mind to business. And I've determined to take him on and make a man of him.
Oh, Caleb!
It seems Fred set on Mr. Fairbrother to talk with Mary.
It's a pity for Mary, I think.
Why pity?
Because, Caleb, she might have had a man who is worth 20 Fred Vinces.
Huh?
I firmly believe Mr. Fairbrother is attached to her and meant to make her an offer now he's the new living. But, of course, Fred uses him as an envoy and there's an end to that prospect.
That would have made me very proud and happy, Susan. But you took me, even though I was a plain man.
I took the best and cleverest man I had ever known.
I expect many thought you might have done better. The lad is good at bottom and clever enough to do, and he loves and honours our daughter beyond anything. And she has given a sort of promise according to how he turns out. That young man's soul is in my hand, and I'll do the best I can for him, so help me God. It's my duty, Susan.
Oh, God bless you, Caleb. Oh, our children have a good father.
It was deuced ill luck, Tertius. Everything was splendid. She has a fine seat, your wife. And then we skirted a damn wood and some damn fool axed a tree right in front of the mare's nose. She took fright. And the lady wife, she didn't fall, you know, cracking seat, but she was a bit shaken. How is she, old boy? You were told never to ride with Mrs. Lydgate after that first time. Deuce I was, old boy. Never mentioned it. Rosamond, she... You will please leave. At once. Rosamond is very ill. It's as bad as can be. I'm here, Rosie.
The baby. Oh, Tertius, the baby. It wasn't the ride, Tertius. It would have happened if I'd stayed at home. The pains, I'd felt something like them before.
No, Fred. I want you to understand the accounts and get the values into your head, so you must buckle to. How are you at writing and arithmetic?
I'm not afraid of arithmetic, Mr. Garth. It always came easily to me. I think you know my writing.
Let us see. Copy me a line or two of that valuation with the figures at the end.
It's very good of you to take the trouble with me, Mr. Garth. Of course, I've not the least claim. I already have a debt to you, which will never be discharged, when I pay the money back.
Yes, my boy, you have a claim. Young ones have a claim on the old to help them forward. All right, let me see that. I can't put up with this.
What can I do, Mr. Garth?
Do? Well, you must learn to form your letters and
keep the line, Fred. What's the use of writing at all if no one can understand it? It's disgusting.
I hadn't thought of desk work. I'm very sorry.
We must make the best of it, Fred. Go at it with a will. Every man can learn to write. I taught myself. Callum shall go on with the books for a bit while you're learning, and you must go home and tell your father the news. There's no going back now, Fred. You must stick at it.
Dear Dodo, do throw off that cap. I'm sure that dress must make you feel ill.
I'm used to it, Celia. The cap has become a sort of shell. I feel rather bare and exposed when it's off.
I must see you without it. It makes us all warm. There.
Ah.
You don't have to wear it anymore among your friends.
My dear Celia, a widow must wear her mourning at least a year.
Not if she marries again before the end of it, Lady Chetham.
Oh, that is very rare, I hope, Mrs. Cadwallader.
Well, if a woman accepts the wrong man, she must take the consequences. But if she can marry blood, beauty and bravery, the sooner the better.
I think the subject of our conversation is very ill chosen. Suppose we change it.
Not on my account, Sir James. I can assure you that no question can be more indifferent and impersonal to me than second marriage. Pray, let Mrs. Cadwallader amuse herself on the subject as much as she likes. I shall never marry again.
Dorothea, you are but 21, my dear. If you incarcerate yourself in that gloomy mansion, you will certainly go mad. Sitting alone in that library at Lowick, you may start to fancy yourself ruling the weather. You will see visions like St. Teresa, and think what a bore you will be to your friends if you are always playing tragedy queen and taking things sublimely.
My friends need not be anxious on my behalf. I have quite other thoughts about my own life. I have delightful plans. I should like to take a great deal of land and drain it and make a little colony where everybody will work and all the work should be done well. I should know every one of my cottagers and be their friend.
You see, it's like a chapter from Lives of the Saints already.
No, this is practical and real. I'm going to have great consultations with Mr. Garth. He can tell me almost everything I want to know.
Then you will be happy if you have a plan. Perhaps little Arthur will like plans when he grows up and then he can help you. Really, Dorothea, taking off your cap has made you just like your old self again.